When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture. Luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Madrid, a new biography, is the miraculous story of Madrid, how a village became a great world city. It is the new biography by Luke Stegman, and I'm delighted to say that Luke joins us live on the line now. Luke, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Giles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to have you with us. We seem to think that Madrid has always been the capital of Spain, but things are somewhat different.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Madrid's only been the capital, well, only, I guess, for the last, coming up for 500 years. But prior to that, Spain, or at least the kingdoms of Castile and Leon and Aragon and so on, had a whole range of shifting capitals. It wasn't until the middle of the 16th century that what became known as Spain fixed its capital right in the center of the peninsula.
And of course, you bring up a really important point, because what we think of Spain, of course, sort of 600 years ago, was a sort of disparate amalgamation of kingdoms.
It was. Well, I mean, 600 years ago, there was still the remains of the Nazari kingdom of Granada, and there was also the kingdoms of Aragon, Castile, Leon, and of course Navarre as well.
So from the offset, Toledo, of course, which is, if you drive out of Madrid, is only what, a half an hour, under an hour from. Mm. That was the original capital.
It was one of the capitals. It was a capital. It was the Visigoth capital that wasn't known as Spain then. Or really, what was the continuation of Roman Hispania, and the the Romans built a city there at Toledum. And then it became the capital of the Visigoths. It was kind of an episcopal city as well. And Toledo to this day is still the most important ecclesiastical centre in Spain. And, you know, there was every possibility that Toledo would have become the permanent capital of Spain. But for a whole range of reasons, it was, you know, the geography there was a little bit too difficult. When Philip II decided to make Madrid his capital, he wanted a place a little bit, even though he's a very pious man, he wanted to be away from sort of meddling priests, and there are a lot of them in Toledo. So for a whole range of reasons, Toledo missed out, as did other places like Valladolid, other important centres like Medina del Campo and so on. And Madrid was the one chosen.
And if you think about it geographically, you couldn't get a better place to have a capital, because it is right, you know, it is dead center in Spain. I mean, it's equidistant from pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, it is. In that respect, it makes perfect sense that smack bang in the center of the Iberian Peninsula would be the capital. Although there's a lot of dispute as to whether that was really the reason why Madrid was chosen. The thing was that when Philip II made that decision in 1561, he didn't leave any documentation behind to explain why he had chosen. There are a whole lot of reasons why Madrid might have been chosen. We've mentioned some of them. But, of course, it's fine being in the geographic center of the peninsula, but as a lot of people have pointed out over the years, critics of Madrid have pointed out, it doesn't have a port, it doesn't have a major waterway, and so on. And, you know, those high central plains of Spain are not always, they used to be very heavily forested, but they've become, you know, quite dry over the years. So, you know, not everybody thinks it's the perfect location, but it is the location now, and it's staying there. So Madrid also has very beautiful surroundings to the north. It has a magnificent chain of mountains to the north.
The thing is, of course, it gets extremely hot at this time of year. That is why pretty much most of Madrid decamps and heads to the coast. And I'm sitting in, you know, on the Costa del Sol, and August is always the month when the Madrileños flock en masse to the coasts.
They do. They like to get out of the city, which is funny because, you know, when you live in Madrid, it's also you meet people who actually love to stay in Madrid during August because the city takes on quite a different character. The streets empty of all the traffic. You know, you can easily get into restaurants and cinemas, and it's really quite lovely. I mean, look. It's true, it's very, very hot. Although, of course, you're speaking to an Australian here, and for me, that heat's kind of normal. I don't mind that. I understand it's a bit overbearing for some people, but Madrid actually can be a really lovely city at the height of summer.
So, because when I think of Madrid, a couple of things, obviously the parks, the palaces, and the artwork. You know, I'm thinking of obviously the Madrid of Velázquez and those wonderful paintings that, and to a certain extent, although it's a flip side of Madrid and the experience, you know, Goya as well. When does Madrid really sort of move into fifth gear in terms of a centre of court and the arts?
There's really a couple of phases for that, Giles. I mean, certainly when Philip II names Madrid his capital, it's curious that he actually then goes and builds a monumental center, sort of administrative center, religious center, library, art gallery, monastery, but he builds it 40 or 50 kilometers outside of Madrid at El Escorial in the mountains. And in a sense, Philip II spent a lot of time ruling what was then a global empire from out at El Escorial. Obviously, with the building of that, and then the following century when Philip IV decided, you know, he thought, well, you know, my grandfather, Philip II, had that sort of monastic retreat. I want to build a pleasure palace. And he built the pleasure palace to the east of the city in what is now the Retiro. In fact, it was called the Buen Retiro. And with constructions like that, of course, there was a need to fill vast wall spaces with paintings, with tapestries. Gardens had to be filled with sculptures. All these magnificent buildings had their associated chapels, and they all had to be filled with altars and paintings. So, you know, really over the 16th, 17th century, Madrid really became a focal point for the arts. And, of course, being the centre of the government of the royal court, that was where patronage was for artists, and it's very difficult for a lot of artists to survive without some kind of patronage. And it's, you know, there were great artists off in Sevilla and in Barcelona and in Valencia at the time as well, but really where all the patronage was at, or most of it, was in Madrid. There was another period then in the late 18th century under Carlos III, another great king of Spain and, you know, often fondly known as the greatest mayor that Madrid has ever had. And he brought in a lot of changes, a lot of sweeping architectural changes, cleaned up the city a lot, brought in broader avenues, reformed the parks and so on. So a lot of these changes, each century has really had its moment. And then, of course, in the early 20th century, in the 1920s and 30s, Madrid had an astounding array of artists. When I say artists, I mean covering all possible media.
Sure.
And, you know, I make the point in the book that people, when they talk about the 1920s and 1930s in Europe, they often talk of Paris in the 20s or Weimar, Berlin. And I make the point that really in terms of, you know, pound for pound, as it were, Madrid had just as many really outstanding writers and artists, photographers, you know, painters and dramatists and so on, as either of those two places. And that's a bit of a story which is not really well known.
You could argue, of course, that because sort of Paris and Berlin are more Central European, and Spain has always been looked at, you know, the saying, Africa begins south of the Pyrenees, there's a little bit of Northern European bias here. I thought it just occurred to me, look, about this, because I'm just thinking, again, I'm based in Andalusia, if during the time when Spain has its golden period and you know, has South America and et cetera, et cetera, and is bringing back these huge amounts of wealth, I'm just thinking about the communication between Cadiz, obviously a beautiful, Sevilla, which is obviously because the river is sailable, the route then to get from Sevilla, because they don't yet have the high-speed rail link that Felipe González will put in, to get from Seville to Madrid. Again, there must have been that sort of tugging of power power from regional capitals, which we are now seeing again, obviously writ large with Barcelona.
No, certainly. I mean, and that was, I mean, in terms of bringing all the treasures which arrived from you know, what was then known as the New World, and up through Cadiz to Sevilla and so on. And then that was all, you know, basically put on horse and cart, or, you know, mules, donkeys and so on. There was no other way of getting all that treasure up to Madrid. It's interesting, isn't it, how, you know, so much, it's true, so much of that wealth, you know, went into, people often say, oh, it was squandered in some ways. A lot of it went into religious buildings, churches and so on. But it's also true that a lot of it was used to finance Spain's wars in Northern and Central Europe, many of which were completely unnecessary. But given that the ruling family was the Habsburgs, they had a lot of interests beyond Spain that they had to defend. So they were fighting wars, you know, most notoriously in Flanders, in the Netherlands, in Germany, and so on. And this was costing an enormous amount of money. It's where a lot of the enormous wealth that Spain made or extracted from South America went to these ultimately fairly useless wars in Central and Northern Europe.
Indeed. Let's get to the earliest 20th century, because you make that point about Madrid being a cultural centre across all of the arts. And whilst people are talking about the Weimar and the Belle Epoque in France and Brussels, etc., Spain, of course, tries to have this sort of modernisation programme, but it is outside of the big capital. Spain is an agricultural society, and church and state and monarchy reign supreme. So perhaps this is the reason why Spain has the flowering of republics and then falls into this ghastly civil war.
Yes, yes. It was some ways, you know, it's kind of seen as a bit of a golden age, but referred to as the Silver Age. Such an enormous flowering of talent in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, particularly the 20s and 30s in Madrid. And that all stopped dead. Not only because Madrid, people in Madrid were engaged in either defending the city or, you know, there's a popular notion that Madrid, well, it was a city under Republican control, and that most people were, you know, out in the trenches and defending from the nationalist forces who were besieging Madrid. It is also true, however, that a lot of people in Madrid just put their heads down and laid low and just sort of rode it out, and then were quite happy when the war was over and the nationalists, you know, came in and took Madrid. So, so that obviously there was that cutting off of that enormous artistic flowering in the 20s and 30s, not only because of the war itself, but the war meant that a lot of those people went into exile. Some were outright killed by one side or the other. Lorca is the most famous example of a sort of cultural victim of the Civil War, but there were plenty of people, writers and so on of conservative tendencies who were shot and killed as well, just simply not quite as famous in name. But that was a lot of those people went to exile, and then some returned, some never did. Some, you know, came back to a Spain completely transformed. The interesting thing was, of course, these people had all been so important in the 20s and 30s. Some of them, when they came back, perhaps in the 40s, 50s, 60s, they found that people really weren't interested in them anymore. It's a great lesson in how, you know, life just moves on, doesn't it? And, yeah. No matter how important we might be in one decade, you know, a decade or two later, oftentimes people have forgotten about us, and that happened to a lot of the exiles.
Yeah, and indeed, and because Spain doesn't get involved in the Second World War, various nefarious British payments, etc., it means that it's... Yes. Exactly, yeah, then that's a whole interview on its own. But it means that Madrid is spared. I mean, it's already been through its horrendous civil war, but it doesn't suffer the effects of a Berlin or of a Dresden or something like that. Architecturally, it is relatively saved, and as you say, people kind of, because when we look back at history, we say, well, I would have stood up against Franco, but everybody, your bank manager, your person who is a clerk, is just going to say, okay, well, let's just get on with it and live the best we can.
That's true. I mean, when Franco's troops entered in Madrid in March 1939, they were welcomed by a lot of people. Now, we might say, well, a lot of people thought, well, you kind of had to be out there welcoming them because it was bad form not to, because, your name would be put on a list or something. But I think it's also true that a lot of people were just fed up. They'd been cold and hungry and suffering for 3 years, and they just wanted it all to be over. And a lot of people were glad that troops were entering the city saying, look, the war's over.
Yeah.
If you were a diehard Republican, as many people were, obviously that's not the ideal scenario, but a lot of people were just happy that it was over.
But when we see, let's fast forward a bit. I mean, Franco dies in 75. He's kind of anointed Juan Carlos to be carry on. Obviously, Juan Carlos pulls a blinder and institutes a democracy. But it still takes a very long time for Spain to sort of reinvent itself. I mean, I moved over here in 85. Spain didn't really. I mean, you've got the Movida in Madrid, which is Spain's 60s happening in its 80s. Fabulous time. But it kicks into gear as a financial and a business capital, really, with the, although they're not in Madrid, Expo 92 in Noventa y Dos in Seville, and of course Barcelona gets the Olympics and lights a fuse there that continues to go till today.
Yes, the modernization of Spain, I mean, it's been really a tremendous. It's interesting because, as you well know, we're in a particularly politically turbulent time in Spain at the moment. And a lot of people, some people would say that's always the case, but a lot of people are looking back with a certain kind of nostalgia at the last 40 years saying, look, the enormous distance Spain has come. And it's true, some of that sort of seems to be unraveling at the moment because there's so much sort of petty politicking going on, whereas that kind of sense of more of national unity that carried through the 80s, but from the 90s on. One of the things we're talking about Madrid has been that really in the 21st century, part of the reinvention of Madrid has been as a kind of financial capital, financial services, digital technology, innovation, all this sort of stuff. Not exactly a kind of Singapore quite, but Madrid is trying to position itself in that way. And I know people have said that they're trying to create a kind of a second version of, the city of London in this new Madrid North, which is being this massive new development. Madrid's going to change. It's changed enormously. I mean, I've known Madrid since the mid 80s, like since you've been in Spain, and the changes is just astonishing. But particularly in the last 10 to 15 years, and I think there's even more of that change coming over the next 10 to 15 years as Madrid continues to completely reinvent itself. And in some respects, and this is a cause both of celebration for some people and of, should we say, angst for some other people, that Madrid has kind of separated itself a little bit from the rest of Spain in terms of its standard of living, in terms of its cosmopolitan workforce, in terms of the number of multinational companies, in terms of the sheer cost of living there. Madrid's an extraordinarily expensive to city to be in nowadays. One thing Madrid's not, it's not that kind of, it had that famous reputation for being like just an oversized village of La Mancha, that's long gone. And you could see remnants of that still even in the mid 80s when I arrived there, but that's long gone now. Madrid's this really, really dynamic global capital now. Still has a fair way to go, but that's really the path it's on.
And also it's, of course, attracting people from, you know, the old country, if you like. If you, you know, you have to walk around Madrid to see, you know, people from the Philippines, South America, Ecuador, people from Romania. It's become this melting pot, like, you know, most European city capitals are. If you think of Paris, Paris isn't reflected of France. London is not reflected of the UK. So it stands alone. And again, for up-and-coming places that proclaim that they are the true heart of whatever country they happen to be, and good morning to my listeners in Barcelona, you know, Madrid is actually, you know, Madrid is getting on with the business of governance and being a financial center quietly, as the Madrilenians tend to be, and not saying, look at us, we're Catalans.
Exactly. And look, you know, it's an invitation to argue with people when I say this, but it's inevitable that you have to see that Madrid's spectacular rise over the last 10 years absolutely mirrors a certain decline in Barcelona, which has come about because of the whole mayhem of the Catalan nationalist, separatist movement. And whatever your position is on that, it's unarguable that, you know, the extraordinary number of companies that left Barcelona or left Catalonia and reallocated, not always necessarily to Madrid, some went to Valencia, Alicante, some went to Malaga, you know, and so on, many indeed. But there's certainly been a great outflow. And that kind of really very kind of inward-looking nationalism, regional nationalism that has been happening in Catalonia, and whereas Madrid has really just been looking out to the world, and you're right. I mean, a lot of big money has come in from particularly Venezuela and places like that, you know, which again leaves Madrid open to this charge. A lot of people like to accuse Madrid of essentially having become a kind of haven for you know, conservative, neoliberal kind of policies and politics, and there are elements of that, of course. But you know, it's interesting that one of the things I studied in writing this book was the long history of reactions to Madrid, particularly adverse reactions to Madrid or negative commentary about Madrid, because that was one thing that I wanted to understand. And it's curious, you know, that when people talk about, you know, Madrid has this reputation of, because it has had conservative governments for so long, oh, Madrid's this ultra-conservative place. But in fact, so many social protest movements in Spain also begin in Madrid. I mean, Podemos was a Madrid phenomenon, really, even though it later spread around. But Podemos, they were, you know, kids from Madrid. And in fact, you know, Podemos is just as much a phenomenon of Madrid as, you know, the more conservative side of the Partido Popular, you know. So it's all there in Madrid. That's the thing.
When it comes to writing like something like this, Luke, I mean, did you not think, what have I taken on here? Because it is such a... It is not something that is easy to write because of the various factions and factors.
You're right. Look, there were a couple of times when I thought, "Oh God, what have I gotten myself into?" Just because, but more because of the sheer length and complexity of the history. You know, as you may well know, anyone, particularly foreigners, but I know a lot of Spaniards as well, when you try to make sense of Spanish politics in the 19th century, it's just so complicated. So working a kind of a path through that was difficult. Then I had to find a balance to discuss the war years in Madrid, because I was not remotely interested in sort of picking a side in that. I wanted to, you know, tell the human story of Madrid. And then I found, Giles, as I got to, you know, you'll notice in the book that the last section, which is kind of into the 20th century, it's very short. It's only about 50 pages out of a book of 500 or so pages. And that is because when you're writing about 1,000 or so years of history, you kind of have to... You kind of have to leave the present moment alone, because it's very—you've got no perspective on it. And also, I found that judgments, particularly value judgments that you make about contemporary things, tend to get very old very quickly. And you know, I've read other books, you know, and some wonderful books about other cities and so on. And you find sometimes there's this final chapter which is kind of discussing kind of. Imagine the author's been there, just typing right up to now in the last pages. And, you know, 10 years later when you read that, you think, oh, this doesn't fit here, you know. Mm. So I had to try and, in a sense, the book really ends, I guess, with the Movida in the 1980s, with just a couple. And that's why to discuss the present moment, I really chose two things. One was the sort of a brief comment about COVID and the way the city was left completely empty for a period of time, and how that was such an unusual thing. And the other thing was the Filomena, the massive snowstorm that occurred in 2021 and just left Madrid completely blanketed for 4 or 5 days. And again, and I say it was a similar thing to COVID in the sense that it left this incredible sense of stillness and quiet over the city. The difference was that in COVID, there was a virus afoot, and weren't allowed outside. Whereas with Filomena, once sort of the dust has settled, once the snow had settled, everyone came out and was skiing up and down the main streets. It was completely unlike anything people had experienced before. So I chose those two moments to kind of represent the current time, because if you start getting engaged in contemporary political debates, it's not a matter of being right or wrong. It just gets old very quickly.
I'm giving you a time machine, Luke. Setting it to Madrid. Where are you going to spend the weekend with a time machine set to Madrid? What period?
Ooh, that's a really, really good question. I think I would probably go back to the 16th or 17th century, sometime around that. I'd like to be that time where you've got a painter like El Greco just down the road in Toledo.
Yeah.
And you've got maybe a young Velázquez just starting to make his way at the court, and you've got all those fabulous writers. You'd probably catch the tail end of Cervantes and people like Lope de Vega. I think that would be a fascinating time. And also that period, Madrid was a tremendous Baroque city in terms of its architecture. So much of that, 80, 90% of that has been lost over the years for one reason or another. So I would have loved to have seen Baroque Madrid at its height.
The book is called Madrid, A New Biography. You can order it via our own online bookstore as well. It's by Luke Stegeman. Luke, can people find you online? Where's the best place to track you down?
Yes, just at Luke Stegeman. I'm on Twitter or X. I'm also on Instagram.
The book is called Madrid. Luke, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's been a great pleasure, Giles. Thanks very much.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.